BBC News.
Read by Vigi Alice. Comedy next this evening as the humorist David Sedaris returns to Radio 4 and the stage with his observations on the human condition, all lovingly captured in his essays and extensive diaries. That's in just a moment.
On BBC iPlayer.
Six robbers have carried out an armed raid, stealing almost 3 tonnes of gold.
Inspired by Britain's biggest gold heist.
How do you shift 3 tonnes of gold?
Slowly.
£26 million worth of pure gold in the possession of people who didn't expect to have it.
If you could handle a job like this, then I'd have heard of you.
You only hear about the people who get caught.
Stealing it was just the start.
We're looking for 6 robbers and 3 tonnes of gold. Every ring, every watch. If you're looking for the gold, it's all around you.
The Gold. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Now on Radio 4, David Sedaris, fresh from the lanes of West Sussex, with a new series of true stories and sometimes proactive thoughts with a transatlantic angle.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet David Sedaris.
Well, thank you. That was so nice of you to show up. I appreciate it. This is an essay that I wrote. It was published in The New Yorker. And years ago, I used to write for Esquire magazine. And if something was in Esquire and if you didn't like it, it could have been a bad essay. But if something's in The New Yorker and you don't like it, there's something wrong with you. That's the general understanding. Happy-go-lucky. Something about a car running over a policeman and a second officer being injured. This is my assessment of a news story broadcast on the television in my father's room at Springmore, the assisted living center he's been in for the past 3 years. It is early April, 3 days before his 98th birthday, and Amy, Hugh, and I have just flown to Raleigh from New York. The plan is to hang out for a while and then drive to our house on Emerald Isle, the C-section. Dad is in his wheelchair, dressed and groomed for our visit, hair combed, real shoes on his feet, a red bandana tied around his neck. "Well, hey," he calls as we walk in, an old turtle raising his head toward the sun. "Gosh, it's good to see you kids." As Amy and I move in to embrace him, Hugh wonders if we could possibly turn off the TV. "Well, sure," my father, still smothered in grown children, says. "I don't even know why it's on, to tell you the truth." Hugh takes the remote off the bedside table, and after he's killed the television, Amy asks if he can figure out the radio. As a non-blood relative, that seems to be his role during our visits to Springmore. The servant. "Find us a jazz station," I tell him. "There we go," my father says. "That would be fantastic." Neither Amy nor I care about the news anymore, at least the political news. I am vaguely aware that my state's governor has fallen out of favor and that people who aren't me will be receiving government checks for some reason or other. But that's about it. When Trump was president, I started every morning by reading the New York Times, followed by the Washington Post, and would track both papers' websites regularly throughout the day. To be less than vigilant was to fall behind. And was there anything worse than not knowing what Stephen Miller just said about Wisconsin? My friend Mike likened this constant monitoring to having a second job. It was exhausting. And the moment that Biden was sworn into office, I let it all go. When the new president speaks, I feel the way I do on a plane when the pilot announces that after reaching our cruising altitude, he will head due north or take a left at Lake Erie. "You don't need to tell me about your job," I always think. "Just, you know, do it." It's so freeing, no longer listening to political podcasts, no longer being enraged. I still browse the dailies, skipping over the stories about COVID, as I am finished with all that as well. The moment I got my first shot of the vaccine, I started thinking of the coronavirus the way I think of scurvy, something from a long ago time that can no longer hurt me, something that mainly pirates get. My father tested positive for the coronavirus shortly before Christmas. At around the time he started wheeling himself to the front desk at Springmore and asking if anyone there had seen his mother. He hasn't got Alzheimer's, nothing that severe. Rather, he's what used to be called soft in the head. Gaga. It's a relatively new development. Aside from the time he was discovered on the floor of his house, dehydrated and suffering from a bladder infection, he's always been not just lucid, but commanding. If it happens several times in one day, someone on the staff will contact me, Lisa told us over the phone. Then I'll call and say, Dad, your mother died in 1976 and is buried beside your father at the rural cemetery in Cortland, New York. You bought the plot next to theirs, so that's where you'll be going. There had to be a gentler way to say this, but I'm not sure the news really registered, especially after his diagnosis when he was at his weakest. Every time the phone rang, I expected to hear that he had died, but my father recovered without being hospitalized, I told my cousin Nancy. Plus, he lost 10 pounds. Not that he needed to. When I ask him what it was like to have COVID, he offers a false-sounding laugh. He does that a lot now. Ha ha! I suspect it is a cover for his failed hearing, that rather than saying, could you repeat that? He figures it a safe bet that you were delivering a joke of some sort. Hugh and I just went to Louisville to see his mother, I'd said to my dad the last time we were at Springmore. Joan is 90 now and has blood cancer. Ha ha! That was on Halloween. Socially distanced visits were allowed in the outdoor courtyard of my father's building, and after our allotted 30 minutes were up, an aide disguised as a witch wheeled him back to his room. Those costumes must do a real number on some of the residents, Amy said as we walked with Hugh to our rental car. And then a vampire came to take my blood pressure. Sure he did, Grandpa. A few days after we saw him, all visits were canceled and Springmore was locked down. No one in or out except staff, and all the residents confined to their rooms. The policy wasn't reversed until 6 months later. That's when we flew down from New York to see him. You look great, Dad, Amy says in a voice that is almost but not quite a shout. Hugh has finally found a jazz station and managed to tune out the static. Well, I'm 100 years old, my father tells us. Can you beat that? 98, Amy corrects him. And not quite yet. Your birthday is on Monday, and today is only Friday. 100 years old. This isn't soft-headedness, but a lifelong tendency to exaggerate. What the hell are you still doing up? He'd demand of my brother, my sisters, and me every school night of our lives. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. We'd point to the nearest clock. Actually, it's 9:45. It's 1 o'clock, damn it. Then how come Columbo is still on? Go to bed. Amy has brought my father some chocolate turtles. And as he looks on, she opens a box and hands him one. Your room looks good, too. It's clean, and your stuff fits in real well. It's not bad, is it? My father says. You might not believe it, but this is the exact same square footage as the house. This is simply not true. But we let it go. There are a few things I'd like to get rid of, but as a whole, it's not too cluttered, he observes, turning a jerky semicircle in his wheelchair. That was a real problem for me once upon a time. I used to be the king of clutter. Were I his decorator, I'd definitely lose the Christmas tree that stands collecting dust on the console beneath his TV. It is a foot and a half tall and made of plastic. Naked, it might be okay, but its baubles, which are the size of juniper berries and gaudy, depress me. Beside it is a stack of cards sent by people I don't know or whose names I only vaguely recognize from the Greek Orthodox Church. Has a priest been by? I ask. My father nods a few times. He doesn't much like me, though. Amy takes a seat on the bed. Why not? He laughs. Let's just say I'm not as generous as I could be. My father is thinner than the last time I saw him, but somehow his face is fuller. Something else is different as well, but I can't put my finger on it. It's like when celebrities get work done. I can see they've undergone a change, but I can never tell exactly what it is. The eyes? The mouth, I wonder? Examining a photo on some gossip site? You don't look the same for some reason, I say to my father. He turns from me to Hugh and then to Amy. Well, you do. All of you do. The only one who's changed is me. I'm 100 years old. 98 on Monday, Amy says. 100 years old. Have you had your COVID vaccine? I ask, knowing that he has. I'm not sure, he says. Maybe. I pick up a salmon carved out of something hard and porous, an antler maybe. It used to be in the basement office at his house. This was before he turned every room into an office and buried himself in envelopes. Hugh and me and Amy, we've each had one shot. My father laughs. Well, good for you. I haven't had a drink since I got here. At first, I take this as a non sequitur. Then I realize that by shot, he thinks we mean a shot of alcohol. They don't let you drink, I ask. Oh, you can have a little, I guess, but it's not easy. You have to order in advance, like medicine, and you only get a thimbleful, he says in his whisper of a voice. What do you think would happen if you had a screwdriver? Amy asks. He thinks for a moment. I'd probably get an erection. I really like this new version of my father. He's charming and positive and full of surprises. One of the things I like about us as a family is that we laugh, he says, always, as far back as I can remember. It's what we're known for. Most of that laughter had been directed at him and erupted the moment he left whichever room the rest of us were occupying. A merriment club member, he definitely was not, but I like that he remembers things differently. My offbeat sense of humor has won me a lot of friends, he tells us. A hell of a lot. Friends here, Amy asks. All over the damn place. Even the kids I used to roller skate with, they come by sometimes. He opens his hand, and we see that the chocolate turtle he's been holding has melted. Amy fetches some toilet paper from the bathroom, and he sits passively as she cleans him off. What is it you're wearing? He asks. She takes a step back so that we can see her black and white polka dot shift. Over it is a Japanese denim shirt with coaster-sized smiley face patches running up and down the sleeves. Her friend Paul recently told her that she dresses like a fat person, the defiant sort who thinks, you want to laugh? I'll give you something to laugh at. Interesting, my father says. Whenever the conversation stalls, He turns it back to one of several subjects, the first being the inexpensive guitar he bought me when I was a child and insisted on bringing with him to Springmore, this after it had sat neglected in a closet for more than half a century. I'm trying to teach myself to play, but I just can't find the time to practice. Seems to me that all he has is time. What else is there to do here? Shut up in this room. I've got to make some music, he says. As he shakes his fist in frustration, I notice that he still has some chocolate beneath his fingernails. You're too hard on yourself, Dad, Amy tells him. You don't have to do everything, you know. Maybe it's okay just to relax for a change. His second go-to topic is the artwork hanging on his walls, most of it bought by him and my mother in the 70s and early 80s. Now this, he says, pointing to a framed serigraph over his bed, this I could look at every minute of the day. It is a sentimental, naive-style street scene of Paris in the early 20th century, a veritable checklist of tropes and clichés by Michel Delacroix, who defines himself as a painter of dreams and of the poetic past. On the two occasions when my father visited me in the actual Paris, he couldn't leave fast enough. It's only in pictures that he can stand the place. I've got to write this guy a letter and tell him what his work means to me, he says. The trick is finding the damn time. Two of the paintings in the room are by my father, done in the late 60s. His art phase came from nowhere, and during its brief 6-month span, he was prolific, churning out 20 or so canvases, most done with a palette knife rather than a brush. All of them are copies of Van Gogh, of Zubrin, and Picasso. I wouldn't fool anyone, but as children, we were awed by his talent. The problem was what to paint, or in his case, to copy. Some of his choices were questionable. A stagecoach silhouetted against a tangerine-colored sunset comes to mind. But in retrospect, it fit right in with the rest of the house. Back in the 70s, we thought of our color scheme as permanently modern. What would dare replace all that orange and brown and avocado? By the early 80s, it was laughable, but now it's back. And we're able to think fondly of our milk chocolate walls and the stout wicker burrow that used to pout atop the piano, one of our father's acrylic bullfighters seemingly afire on the wall behind it. When Dad retired from IBM, the artwork became a greater part of his identity. He had been an engineer, but he was an art lover. This didn't extend to museums. Who needed them when he had his living room? I'm an actual collector, while David, he's more of an investor. He sniffed to my friend Lee after I bought a Picasso that was painted by Picasso and did not look, dare I say it, like cake frosting. Then there's my father's collection of masks, some of which are hanging high on the wall over his bed. The best of them were made by tribes in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, bought on fly fishing trips. A few others are African or Mexican. They used to leer down from the paneled wall above the staircase in our house, and it is odd but not unpleasant to see them in this new setting. When walking down the hall at Springmore, I always peek into the other rooms, none of which resemble my father's. There are the neighbors, and then there is Dad. Dad, who is listening to Eric Dolphy and holding the guitar he has never in his life played. You know, 4 of the strings on this thing came off my old violin, the one I had in grade school. No, they didn't. But who cares? Before his mind started failing, my father consumed a steady diet of Fox News and conservative talk radio that kept him at a constant boiling point. Who's that black guy? He demanded in 2014. The family was together at the C-section, and we were talking about Michael Brown, who had been shot and killed 3 months earlier in Ferguson, Missouri. What black guy? I asked. Oh, you know the one. Bill Cosby? Amy offered. Gil Scott-Heron? I asked. Stevie Wonder? Gretchen called from the living room. Lisa said, Denzel Washington? You know who I mean, Dad said. He's got that son. Jesse Jackson? He's the one. Always stirring up trouble. Now, though, our father has taken a few steps back, and like me, seems all the better for it. How did you feel when Biden was elected, I ask. The question is a violation of the pact Amy and I made before arriving. Don't rile him up. Don't confuse him. Actually, he says, I was for that other one. Hugh says, Trump. My father nods. That's right. I believed what he was telling us. And well, it seems that I was wrong. That guy was bad news. Never did I expect to hear this. Trump was bad and I was wrong, practically in the same breath. Who are you? I want to ask the gentle gnome in front of me. And what have you done with Lou Sedaris? So Biden, I guess he's okay, my father says, looking with his red bandana like the leftist he never was. Amy, Hugh, and I are just recovering when an aide walks in and announces that it is 5 o'clock, time for dinner. I'll wheel Mr. Sedaris down. Oh, we'll take him, Amy says. Take what? My father asks, confused by the sudden activity. I push him out the door and past the TV upon which the news is playing. Again, the incident at the Capitol, someone hit by a car, someone shot. This is like that old joke, I say to my father as we near the dining room. A man bitches to his wife, you're always pushing me around and talking behind my back. And she says, what do you expect? You're in a wheelchair. My father roars, The dining room, which fits maybe 6 tables, is full when we arrive. Women greatly outnumber men, and no one except for us and the staff is ambulatory. The air should smell like food, but instead it smells like Amy, her perfume. She wears so much that it manages to both precede her and trail behind her, lingering long after she's moved on. That said, I like it. A combination of 5 different scents, none of which is flowery or particularly sweet. It leaves her smelling like a strange cookie, maybe one with pencil shavings in it. Eat, why don't you? My father says. I am conscious of everyone watching. Visitors. Lou has visitors. While Hugh and Amy talk to an aide, my father looks up and pats the space beside him at the table. Stay for dinner. They can make you anything you want. I can't remember my mother's last words to me. They were delivered over the phone at the end of a casual conversation. See you, she might have said, or I'll call back in a few days. And in the thoughtless way you respond when you think you have forever with the person on the other end of the line, I likely said, okay. My father's last words to me, spoken in the too hot, too bright dining room at his assisted living facility 3 days before his 98th birthday, are, don't go yet. Don't leave. My last words to him, and I think they're as telling as his, given all we've been through, are, we need to get to the beach before the grocery stores close. They look cold on paper. And when he dies a few weeks later, and I realize they are the last words I said to him, I will think, maybe I can warm them up on stage when I read this part out loud. For rather than thinking of his death, I will be thinking of the story of his death. So much so that after his funeral, Amy will ask, Did I see you taking notes during the service? There'll be no surprise in her voice. Rather, it will be the way you might playfully scold a squirrel. Did you just jump up from the table and completely empty that bird feeder? The squirrel in me, it's in our nature. Though maybe not forever. For our natures, I have just recently learned from my father, can change. Or maybe they're simply revealed. And the dear, cheerful man I saw that afternoon at Springmore was there all along, smothered in layers of rage and impatience that burned away as he blazed into the home stretch. For the moment, though, leaving the dining room in the company of Hugh and Amy, I am thinking that we'll have to do this again, and soon fly to Raleigh, see Dad, maybe have a picnic in his room. I'll talk Gretchen into coming. Lisa will be there too, and our brother Paul. All of us together, and laughing so loudly we'll be asked by some aide to close the door. Because really, isn't that what we're known for? I was going to read a few things here from my diary. April 23rd, 2011, Tempe, Arizona. A joke from last night's book signing. A woman leafs through the morning paper and looks up at her husband. It says here that women in Las Vegas get $100 every time they have sex. That sounds like a pretty good deal, so I'm going to move there. I'll go with you, her husband tells her. I want to see how you live on $200 a year. September 2nd, 2020, Rackham, West Sussex. Andrew and I had dinner together at the pub last night. Did you see the picture of that graffiti-covered wall somewhere in the U.S., he asked, as we pulled our Xeroxed menus from a pot in the center of the table? It originally said, Black Lives Matter. Then someone added an O, so now it's Black Olives Matter. October 23rd, 2021, Chicago. The highlight of yesterday was my four-hour drive from Springfield to St. Louis with Katie, who is 38 and on her second marriage. On our way, we passed many billboards that advertised the wonders of Uranus, an unfortunately named town that decided after years of being made fun of to double down and make the best of it. They now have a fudge factory, Katie explained. That was noted on one of the billboards, which read, "The best fudge comes from Uranus." Others included Big Fun in Uranus and Explore Uranus. It was one of those things that never stopped being funny.
Meet David Sedaris was written and read by David Sedaris. The producer was Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for the BBC.
And David will be back with more stories next week. And in case you missed it, you'll find his recent turn on Desert Island Discs on BBC Sounds. What do the critics make of a new immersive art exhibition featuring David Hockney's work? More on that on Front Row in 15 minutes. On Radio 4...
Our Father,
who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name.
The Lord's Prayer is shared by Christians around the world.
On earth as it is in heaven.
In this year's Lent talks, six people reflect on the words of this prayer,
as we forgive those who trespass against us,
sharing stories of forgiveness, fatherhood, and finding heaven on earth.
For thine is the kingdom.
Lent talks on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Forever.